1-904-884. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.
Progressive Radio Network. The Thinking Person Station.
Next time on Peace Talks Radio, regular folks becoming peace ambassadors through online training.
It's not what my design is for you to do. Maybe it's poetry, maybe it's dancing, maybe it's wildly different than I could ever imagine doing. That's what you should be doing for peace.
James O.D., he's among our guests next time on Peace Talks Radio.
Stay tuned for the best information on health and nutrition, current events, economics, the environment, and more on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. I've been back in New York City. I've just finished 5 months on the road, traveling all over the place, filming two very important socially relevant documentaries. Hopefully I'll have one completed. We're in post-production. As I'm filming, I send in the footage each day, and so I have a team working on it, and hopefully by, another month, we'll have a premiere. Today, it's just another broadcast day sharing a lot of positive self-empowering information. For example, we're going to take a look at opiates that are used in most pain treatment and ask a basic question. Do they work? And then we're going to give you the latest on that. Then we're going to talk about green tea extracts and how, if you've been a smoker, it can help slow down lung damage. Also today, superfoods. We're going to discover one that rarely is used in America today, but was in the 1970s, and that is bee pollen. I'll give you all the reasons why bee pollen is good for you. And also, from Science Daily, curcumin, even more benefits than what we knew before. And the CDC has now officially blocked a vaccine whistleblower from a medical malpractice case. So from the World Mercury Project, we'll tell you how bad is the CDC. Also today, we'll let you know of a new group, brand new group of scientists, senior scientists, lodging ethics complaints against the CDC. These scientists are talking about how, everything at the CDC is based upon corruption. And these are people who've been there a long time. How many? Right now there's over a dozen. Well, if you have a dozen willing to go public, senior scientists, lodging ethics complaint, you can believe there are a lot more behind the scenes. They call themselves SPIDER, Scientific Preserving Integrity, Diligence, and Ethics and Research. So we'll share that with you in an exclusive. Also today, if you use your computer or smartphone, you'll want to hear what I have to say about the latest research on that. And how can you become more socially, politically active in helping turn the mess we're living in around? I'll share that. Also, drugs kill more people than cars or guns, and there is an epidemic of this. Mother Jones does a good piece on this, and I'll share some of that. And from our audio file today, I talked about the deep state, and I remember about an hour after I spoke about the deep state, about 5 years ago, when I did a big special on it. We did almost 2 hours. I was walking down the street from our office. And at that time, our office was 83rd and Broadway. And a person stopped me and said, I listened to your show today. Do you really think anyone's going to buy into the idea that there's a deep state? I said, not today. No, you're right. They won't. They have to be given some assurance that such a thing actually exists, meaning inside of our government and the three branches, there is another government that actually has more control than the one that we hear about, the people that we see, and what we know. And they are the ultimate authorities because they have the power to do whatever they want, and they do so with impunity. Today, I'm going to play you a segment called The Deep State. And it's about a top-ranking congressional researcher for 28 years, Mike Lofgren, who I had on this program, but he's speaking with Bill Moyers, and they're talking about the deep state, which is elected and unelected figures colluding, meaning conspiring, to protect and serve powerful vested interest. Quote, from his, what he has to say, it is how we had deregulation, financialization of the economy, the Wall Street bust, the erosion of our civil liberties and perpetual war. That's just some of what they're going to talk about. Also, I think it's important for the citizens, average people, to have their say on our stolen democracy. So today, how the Democratic Party lost the election and lost its soul and lost its mind. A citizen journalist offers a public comment about this. And so we'll play you some of that. If time permits, some new information from autism parents. So we have a lot to share, as we do every day. And just so you understand what we're dealing with today and how it might differ from decades ago, maybe you heard me originally on WMCA radio. I recognize, and I think this is important that I share this with you because we have so many new listeners. I mean, the number of people listening to this program on a daily basis is astronomical. In fact, of all the people, the 10 or 11,000 stations that use telephones, we're number one in the world. We're also number one listening live, number one of all that we're talking about on the same list as Sean Hannity and Michael Savage and a lot of conservatives. They have huge audiences, and Laura Ingraham and Tom Hartman. But we dwarf them all, just listening on a telephone, not including all the stations, not including over the internet. And just last month, I think I was given figures of 28 million. So we're talking about huge numbers of people. Who are these people? Why are they coming? What do they want? Okay, to answer that question, I'm going to take you back to 1975 on WMCA Radio. We had an outstanding lineup then. We had Steve Powers and Bruce Williams. We had Larry King live, Sally Jesse Raphael, Barry Gray, who had been on radio for decades, Barry Farber, Long John Neville, Candy Jones, and right in the middle of the afternoon in the dead hour was me. And every day I noticed that the same calls came in. Older people with physical problems. And 99% of my calls were for people who had these problems. And no matter how I answered the question, it always went more and more and more. So one day I went to the program director and I said, these are not the people I want to speak with, not that I don't want to help them, but I want to talk with young people and talk about all the other things that are interesting in life, that are important about health, mental health, physical health, political health, social issues, environmental issues, of which I was, before I even went on the radio, I was already had 12 best-selling books, and I had hundreds of articles published, and as a leading consumer advocate, doing debates, and very much into the environment, was one of the people helping to ban DDT. And I said, we're not talking about any of this on the radio. And his comment was this. He said, well, radio is about people, and if you have enough people, then you get advertisers. And I said, yeah, for hemorrhoid or cream. Who can sell anything to these people? Why not young people? And he said, well, the only young people you hear on radio are people listen to rock. And I said, then you're missing something. He said, if you want to take a chance, do it. But understand if you fail, you've lost your job. I said, fine, because I don't want a job being on radio talking to people about conditions. I know they're not going to change, and they just want to get on the radio and vent. And so I told the audience exactly what I was going to do. The whole program was going to be based upon sharing investigative reporting and white paper and environmental issues and health and nutrition, absolutely, but health and nutrition to prevent illnesses and natural approaches to help you if you were sick. And so that's what I did. And he was not getting. Overnight, my audience just dropped through the floor. I had almost no audience left. I didn't have a big audience to begin with. I had a tiny little audience. They stuck me in the dead part of the day. I was grateful to be there. So I said, okay, well, and he said, look, you don't have an audience. And I said, good. If I don't have that audience, and I actually did something, I almost got fired the day I did it. I said, the person you should speak to is over on WR. Dr. Carlton Fredericks is happy to talk with older people who are sick because that's all he ever talks about. So why don't you go listen to him? And to suggest on one radio station that you should have your audience go to another radio station, it's not taken lightly. Fortunately, the owner of the station, Ellen Strauss, was out of the country at that time, or she'd have fired me on the spot. Anyhow, I did away with the entire format, meaning short interviews of 7 minutes. I remember having Linus Pauling on for 7 minutes, and then she came in and was waving her hand like, wrap it up, you know, go to the next one. And I was having to do all these interviews with great minds that I'd gotten as guests in 7 minutes. Well, you can't interview anyone in 7 minutes and do justice to it. So anyhow, I did away with that. I took whatever time it needed to do an interview. And then I did the first ever cover dish dinner. Now, no one had ever done a cover dish dinner. Never. I asked around, and I just wanted to see who the audience was. So I said, all of you bring a dish, and we're going to meet at this restaurant and bring a vegan dish, and you can socialize, and we'll have a chance to get to know one another, and then you can tell me the issues you want me to talk about and research, and I will. And if you're not a cook, if you don't feel comfortable doing it, we'll find a restaurant that you can go in and that does family style. So you'll buy a dish and that'll be your contribution. And it was free. And the first one we did was, well, 1,400 people showed up. 1,400 people. It was so huge, they had to open up the whole parking lot and at this mall out in Long Island. Now, there's a photograph of that someone took that, in fact, People Magazine happened to have been there and did a feature, but you see that up on the website where people have been sending hundreds and thousands of photos, and we're grateful for that because I wouldn't have gotten them otherwise. And it was a wonderful opportunity, and there were all kinds of people, a lot of young people, though, a lot of older people. In fact, older and younger people in the same family where, oh, this is my daughter, she's just into health, and I wanted her to hear what you had to say, and oh, this is my son. He's thinking about going to medical school. What advice can you give him? So then I started doing it on a monthly basis. And then we wanted to do it in New Jersey and Connecticut and did He Says here in New York. Everyone was packed. In fact, we'd have to sometimes start at 6 o'clock, then 9 o'clock, then 11 o'clock, because we'd have 1,500 people coming in. We'd get the biggest restaurants. And then I did a cooking class. And it was upstate at the Fertiller Farm, and I can only hold 50 people, 49 young guys and one woman. Well, you can imagine what that was like. 49 guys in their 20s, and we go out in the morning and do runs, play volleyball, have cooking classes. Everybody was making two or three different dishes. It was just wonderful. And we did all these wonderful things that were all proactive, and then we started doing things on the environment. And then we would show up and we would do ways that we could help in the inner city. In fact, one of the people in the audience opened up the whole ideas in the schools in Harlem to have a healthy meal. Start, just an experiment. Here's your regular institutional food, tasteless, bad nutrition, and here's something interesting. here's healthy salads and sandwiches made out of sprouted wheat, and there's all these other dishes. And at the time, it wasn't vegan. It was vegetarian because we also used organic dairy. It was enormously successful. And then other schools got on board, and then principals and teachers. It was a phenomenal movement. There were so many calls coming in every day of progressive ideas of doing things proactively, finding solutions. And that's where someone said, hey, you talk about health, and let's get together, and why don't you form a running club and show us all how to get healthy. Now, are you ready for this? It was 41 years this July 4th. And I did it out on the boardwalk in Long Island. And there were 5,500 people show up. How do I know? Because I had T-shirts made. And I gave a T-shirt out free to everyone who showed up. And one of the guys who showed up would go on to become one of the world's greatest athletes, still is to this day, Sid Howard. And so everybody wanted to get into shape. So showed him how to jog, showed him how to power walk. It was a lot of fun. Now, mind you, that was more people showed up than what I had been shown on the Arbitron. So I'm wondering where all these people. Well, the next Arbitron came in, and guess what? We went from about 1,200 to around 20,000 listeners. So I went from the lowest guy on the station to number one in audience. And then it grew from there until we had the number one radio program in America of over 5,000 stations in the afternoon. And what did I talk about? Health and nutrition, alternative approaches to aging and disease, and then social issues, things that were a problem that we should face and honor, the very things I'm doing now. So for those people who say, didn't you always used to talk about health? You bet. As well as all the other important issues that some people tune on and they just like the health. Other people just like the hard-hitting investigative report. Other like the quality of the interviews with Conversations with Remarkable Minds. Others like that whole hard-hitting one-hour Tuesday night program I do called the Progressive Commentary Hour. So it hasn't changed in all these decades. So for those tuning in, find the part of the program that suits your own needs. And if you find something else doesn't, you leave that be, because there will always be that part there that makes a difference. Just wanted to leave that as a little background because we have a lot of new people. Also, a lot of people say, who's Gary Nall? I live in Spain. I just got interested in this. My mother had cancer. We didn't know what to do. She wasn't succeeding with orthodox therapy. And so on the internet, someone says, well, contact Gary Nall. He works with terminal patients. So I contacted, and then I saw you do a radio program, and who are you? To help you understand who I am, my staff put together 7 video bios. So if you want to know who I am as an investigative journalist, who I am as an environmentalist, who I am as a radio broadcaster, who I am as an author, who I am as a person with over 37 different specials on PBS stations, lecturing before 5,000 people, you have each and every one of these that show you the whole history of what I've done from then until now. So at least you won't have to guess or get misinformation. You'll have it right there. And thousands of articles there on the web for you each day, and progressive stories that you're not going to read out elsewhere. So I welcome you all today, and I'm not going to have a guest today, because I want to get into these other issues. Now, I want to talk about this study on opiates. The Giesinger Health System took a look at a new study, and the physicians report, quote, that the use of opiate therapy to treat chronic pain is not only ineffective, but it actually increases the likelihood of more harmful consequences, including death. The pain care physician, Dr. Meller Davis, and Dr. Mehta authored the study, which proves that you should really be conscious about how dangerous these chronic opiate therapies are. And this was published in Current Oncology Reports. Quote, when patients are given opiate therapy for chronic pain, there's evidence that it interferes with the body's natural resolution of pain. So, here's what they're saying. If you have pain, And let's say you have pancreatic cancer pain, which is terrible. There are therapies you can take, but stay away from the opiate pain because A, they can become addictive, and B, they're not helping you, and C, they can cause you to die. And also, finally, from our public health segment, as you know, we had a man on the show several years ago, Dr. Hooker, Brian Hooker from California, straight shooter, a scientist. He had been contacted by Dr. William Thompson, a long-term senior scientist at the CDC. Now, why he chose Brian Hooker, I don't know. But in a whole series of conversations, he did a mea culpa. He talked about what he had done wrong. Everyone else in his team had done wrong. In effect, they had taken studies clear back to 2003 and on African-American boys 36 months and younger that showed over a 220% increase in autism, and they altered them. Now, that's a felony. That's a federal crime. And it shows you the fraud of the FBI and the FBI director, because that's a case he should have been all over. Because he didn't know he was being taped, and all the conversations were taped. And then when he found out he'd been taped, and Hooker said, you're going to have to do something about this. Because remember, it was the entire team in England of gastroenterologists, of which Andrew Wakefield was one of the lead members, that were excoriated, especially by Anderson Cooper on CNN, denigrated, libeled, slandered all over the world media as being frauds, and two of them had their license taken away because they were suggesting, they didn't state it, they suggested an association between vaccines, the MMR vaccine, and disruptions in the mitochondria of the bowel, which the parents believed from these 12 children could have been due to the vaccines and causing the children's autism. All the children were diagnosed with autism. And then it wasn't Andrew Wakefield or his team that diagnosed the autism. They were merely looking at considerable factors. And they published an article that the Lancet published that later had to be retracted. So if what he was telling Brian Hooker was correct and he was being honest about all the deception, that would have completely cleared, 100% cleaned the record for Wakefield and all of the other researchers. But boy, what it says about the CDC. So then he went public. He went public, and he gave tens of thousands of documents, not only to Brian Hooker and showing other frauds at the CDC, but also to a legislator in Florida who's been trying to get hearings all this time. But there's so much power at the CDC and the pharmaceutical industry to keep this quiet hasn't come forward. Here's the latest. This is a special report from World Mercury Project. Quote, Thomas Frieden, the director of the CDC, has blocked CDC whistleblower Dr. William Thompson from testifying on scientific fraud and destruction of evidence by senior CDC officials in critical vaccine safety studies regarding the causative relationship between childhood vaccines and autism. Attorneys Brian Smith and Robert Kennedy Jr. of Morgan & Morgan have been seeking to have Dr. Thompson testify in a medical malpractice case to explain how the CDC committed scientific fraud in a series of studies which found no link between vaccines and autism. That's the CDC study found no link. Well, in point of fact, they did find a link, and they hid it, destroyed the evidence. So in denying the request, Dr. Friedman said, quote, Dr. William Thompson's deposition testimony would not substantially promote the objectives of the CDC and the Health and Human Services, end quote. You think? Yeah. Whoa. Let's back up a moment. So the head of the CDC is saying, well, we know that the scientists who work for us were committing fraud, and we know that they destroyed evidence. They engaged in destruction of critical documents, and this could make us look bad, and that wouldn't serve the CDC's interest of trying to pretend that we're actually a legitimate scientific agency. Well, you're not a legitimate scientific agency. You're a bunch of pimps. All of you. Shame on you. And you should be held in contempt by the entire African-American community. And I hope, my hope is that Louis Farrakhan gets his followers together and marches on the CDC and camps out and engages in a public strike until those who have been engaged in destruction of evidence, and that's a felony, obstruction of evidence, and get this before the public. Let Thompson go public under oath, and then all the others who've been engaged in this deception, let them come forward under oath. And if you can't do that, then you should close down the CDC because it has no value at all. Then, so he's saying, we're not going to allow him to testify. Well, Congressman William Posey of Florida has been trying to get a hearing. And the members of Congress are so utterly corrupt, so compromised by money from the pharmaceutical industry and the vaccine industry, that they're not about to have that testimony. So here's a major story with incredible implications for every kid out there that's taking an MMR vaccine. And especially if you're African-American, you can end up with autism. They know it. They hid the evidence. They lied. They obstructed justice. And obstruction of justice is a felony. So let him have his day. If we really care about freedom of choice, and let him tell the truth. Not about to allow that to happen. This is separate. And this is something you're not aware of. I want to share this with you now. This is from Natural Health. Quote, in a letter to the CDC chief of staff, over a dozen senior scientists lodged an ethics complaint stating their fear that the CDC's mission is, quote, being influenced and shaped by rogue parties and outside interest, and that taxpayers are being cheated. In the letter signed by CDC SPIDER, or Scientists Preserving Integrity, Diligence, and Ethics in Research, the group claimed that Congress's intent for the CDC is being circumvented by its own leaders, and that unethical practices threaten to undermine the integrity and credibility of the federal agency. Specifically, the scientists are troubled by the close three-way ties between Coca-Cola Company, the International Life Sciences Institute, a nonprofit interest group Coca-Cola supports, and a pair of highly placed CDC officials, Dr. Barbara Bauman and Dr. Michael Pratt. Bauman, former director of the CDC's Division of Heart Disease and Stroke Prevention, retired from the CDC after emails revealed that she offered guidance to a leading Coca-Cola advocate in an attempt to sway World Health authorities regarding sugar and beverage policy matters. Also involved, Dr. Michael Pratt, who works closely with the ILSI, the Life Science Institute, which advocates on behalf of food and beverage industries. Emails suggest that Pratt has a pattern of promoting and helping to lead Coca-Cola-funded research, even co-authoring research papers at least partly funded by the soft drink giant. Pratt has also accepted a position at University of California, San Diego, while employed by the CDC, a truly troubling situation and one which has already drawn the attention of national news outlets, including The Hill and The Huffington Post. The CDC is an agency intended to protect and preserve public health. Yet some of its key officials are advancing the interests of the food and beverage industry and the sugar-laden drinks it merchandises to the American people. As the CDC's own statistics attest, rates of obesity are soaring. 36% of Americans are obese, with an average cost of $147 billion a year for obesity-related. And then it talks about how the CDC cooks the books. By the way, this is the same CDC that engaged in the Tuskegee experiment, and that went on for over 40 years. So it looks like they haven't done a thing to clean up and get rid of the malfeasance there. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. And also a couple things we can as a society and individually begin to do. First and foremost, take action. Promote urban farming and beekeeping. Try to get through your local city councils and communities and community boards. Try to get old buildings that are no longer of value on blocks that no longer can be inhabited. Tear it down. Get the city to tear it down and then build community farming gardens there so that you can have an educational source for children and food for the people in that area. So let's get into restoration of deserted buildings for low-income housing that could put people in the area who have trades, carpentry, electricity, plumbing, to work. And also, it creates extra education at all levels, natural and personal health, environmental, social development, etc., reintroducing and preparing veterans and prison inmates back into society by working on community projects, organizing these projects in communities where you take an old, ratted building and you make it habitable, if it's structurally possible, or you help in its deconstruction and build something better in its place. Also, children and youth programs on practical skills other than standard school subjects and local community food banks. So these are just a few of the things. I have a lot more. I have over 100 of these. Just want to share a few at a time so that we can start to see the people turning around their own society. Now I'm going to go to an audio clip, and I'm only going to play a small amount of this. We're going to hear what a former 28-year member of Congress had to say, because no longer is it considered, what do you mean deep state? When I first brought that to the attention of this audience years ago, now it's gone mainstream. Now everybody acknowledges the deep state exists, but they're not willing to do anything about it. Listen in to Bill Moyers interviewing Mike Lofgren, L-O-F-G-R-N, on this topic.
Welcome. If you've read the espionage novels of John le Carré, you know that no other writer today has so brilliantly evoked the subterranean workings of government, perhaps because he himself was once a British spy. Le Carré has a name for that invisible labyrinth of power. He calls it the deep state. And now, an American you're about to meet in this broadcast has seized on that concept to describe the forces he says are controlling our government, no matter the party in power. But Mike Lofgren's no intelligence agent, although he had a top secret security clearance. He's a numbers man, a congressional staff member for 28 years with the powerful House and Senate budget committees. Over the years, as he crunched those numbers, he realized they didn't add up. Instead, they led him to America's own deep state, where elected and unelected figures collude to protect and serve powerful vested interests. Mike Lofgren was so disgusted, he not only left Capitol Hill, he left the Republican Party and wrote this book, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. Now, at our request and exclusively for BillMoyers.com, he has written Anatomy of the Deep State. You'll want to read it as soon as we finish this conversation. Mike Lofgren, welcome.
Good to be here again, Bill.
This is a difficult subject to talk about. It would be easier if it were a conspiracy you're describing, but that's not the case, is it?
No, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. This is not some cabal that was hatched in the dark of night. This is something that hides in plain sight. It's something we know about, but we can't connect the dots, or most people don't connect the dots. It's kind of a natural evolution when so much money and political control is at stake in the most powerful country in the world. This has evolved over time.
And you call it the real power in the country.
Correct. It is a hybrid of corporate America and the national security state. Everyone knows what the military-industrial complex is, since Eisenhower talked about it in his farewell address.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
Everyone knows Wall Street and its depredations. Everyone knows how corporate America acts. They're both about the same thing. They're both about money, sucking as much money out of the country as they can, and they're about control, corporate control and political control.
You said this, in your judgment, is the big story of our time.
It is the big story of our time. It is, I would say, the red thread that runs through the history of the last three decades. It's how we had deregulation, financialization of the economy, the Wall Street bust, the erosion of our civil liberties, and perpetual war.
You write that the secret and unaccountable deep state floats freely above the gridlock between both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue is the paradox of American government in the 21st century.
Well, that's just the thing. The common narrative of the last 5 years, and on a superficial level, it's right, is that government is broken, it's dysfunctional, it's gridlocked. Well, that's true, and that is the visible government, the constitutional government we learn about in Civics 101, and it is gridlocked. But somehow Obama can go into Libya, he can assassinate U.S. citizens, he can collect all our phone records without a by your leave from anyone. He can even bring down a jet carrying a president of a sovereign country without asking anyone's permission, and no one seems to connect the two. The failure of our visible constitutional state and this other government that operates according to no constitutional rules or any constraint by the governed.
You go on to say, though, that it's not just the executive branch, that is the heart of this, that is just one of the several constituencies that make up what you call the deep state.
Well, it's all the national security functions of the government. It's the Pentagon, it's Homeland Security, it's the State Department. It's also Treasury, because they have a kind of symbiotic relationship with Wall Street.
For one thing, they control the flow of money.
Absolutely. And that's why there's such a flow not only of money but of personnel between Wall Street and the Treasury Department. There's other aspects of government. There's a portion of the judiciary, a small portion of the judiciary, the so-called foreign intelligence surveillance courts. Most of Congress doesn't even know how they operate.
Talk a little bit more about the nexus, the connection between the national security state and Wall Street, because this is a theme that runs through your essay.
Do you know that about 30 blocks north of here, there is a restaurant that will sell you a truffle for $95,000? Also in New York, Christie's sold at auction a painting by Francis Bacon for $142 million. Now, a parallel situation with the national security state, the NSA spent $1.7 billion to build a facility in Utah that will collect one yottabyte of information. That's as much information as has ever been written in the history of the world. It costs $400 by the time the Pentagon finishes paying contractors to haul 1 gallon of gasoline into Afghanistan. That's a real extravagant amount of money. In both cases of the national security state and the corporate state, they are sucking money out of the economy. As our infrastructure collapses, we have a tinker toy power grid that goes out every time there's inclement weather. Tens of millions of people are on food stamps. We incarcerate more people than China, an authoritarian state with 4 times our population. Does anyone see the disparity between this extravagance for the deep state and the penury that is being forced on the rest of the country? That isn't a natural evolution. Something made it happen. We're having a situation where the deep state is essentially out of control. It's unconstrained. Since 9/11, we have built the equivalent of 3 Pentagons around the D.C. metropolitan area, holding defense contractors, intelligence contractors, and government civilians involved in the military-industrial complex. There are over 400,000 contractors, private citizens who have top secret security clearances.
And they are heart and soul of the deep state, as you describe it.
Absolutely.
They're being privatized, which means the power shifts from accountable officials to unaccountable contractors.
About 70% of the intelligence budget goes to contracts.
How new is this? I mean, back in 2010, the Washington Post published a stunning investigation of what the editors called Top Secret America. I mean, we have known about this, have we not?
Yes, we know about this, but the intelligence functions of the government are too important to outsource in the manner we have. It's something where absolute discretion is needed and absolute trust that they are not violating civil liberties. And to put this kind of a burden, if you will, on private contract employees is, I think, become a great disservice.
You say that you came to question this. It took you a while. It was a gradual enlightenment that took place. You were dealing with big numbers and particular details in the budgets that all of these agencies were sending to you when you were on Capitol Hill, right? You were seeing the numbers.
Absolutely.
What was happening to the numbers?
At the end of 2001, is we appropriated a lot of money, and it didn't seem to be going to Afghanistan, the proximate source of the 9/11 attacks. It seemed to be going to the Persian Gulf region, and I said, what's going on here? Saddam Hussein didn't bring down the Twin Towers. So the little light went on, and I began to sort of disenchant myself from the normal groupthink that tends to take over in any organization.
Groupthink. At some point in your essay, you talk about how groupthink drives the deep state.
It absolutely does, just as it tends to drive any bureaucratic organization.
What do you mean by groupthink?
Well, the psychologist Irving Janis called it groupthink. It's a kind of assimilation of the views of your superiors and your peers. It's becoming a yes man. And in many respects, it's an unconscious thing.
I remember what Upton Sinclair once said, it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding it.
That is certainly a part of it.
You describe Washington as clearly and obviously the headquarters of the deep state, but talk about some of the others who are in the game.
Wall Street is perhaps the ultimate backstop to the whole operation because they generate so much money that they can provide second careers for a lot of the government operatives. They're going to make more money than they ever dreamed they would on Wall Street. And I think a good example of that is the most celebrated soldier of the last decade, David Petraeus. What did he do when he retired? He went to Kohlberg Kravis Roberts, a Wall Street buyout firm with $90 billion in assets under management.
You describe him as a kind of avatar of the deep state.
He is, in a way, because he now represents both ends of it. We see now our present-day Cincinnatus did not pick up the plow when he laid down the sword.
Cincinnatus was the Roman who left his farm to become a general in the war. When the war was over, he went back to be a farmer. That doesn't happen today.
No, it doesn't. The vast majority of generals seem to end up on the boards of defense contractors.
Talk a little bit about what you call this strange relationship between Silicon Valley and the government and how it fits into the deep state.
Well, the National Security Agency could not do what it does. The CIA could not do what it does without Silicon Valley. Now, Silicon Valley, unlike the defense contractors, mostly sells to private individuals and to companies. It's not a big government vendor. However, its services are necessary. And de facto, they have become a part of the NSA's operations. I'm sure the CEOs of some of these companies try to obscure the fact that this has mostly been voluntary for many years.
You mean the surveillance?
The surveillance.
The gathering of information on unknowing citizens.
Absolutely.
For commercial purposes, though.
Precisely. They've done it themselves, and they've assisted the NSA through a FISA court order.
Foreign Intelligence
Surveillance Act. So this has been going on for quite a while, yet now, like Inspector Raynaud, they are shocked to find out. But I think their main shock is that they're now starting to lose market share in foreign countries.
These moguls, as you call them, pass themselves off as libertarians.
They do. They make a big pretense about being libertarians and believing in the rugged individualism and so forth, but they've been every bit as intrusive as the NSA has been in terms of collecting your data for commercial purposes rather than so-called national security purposes, but they're in it just as heavily as the NSA is. And they somehow managed to get the intellectual property laws rigged so that you are theoretically subject to a fine of up to $500,000 for jailbreaking your phone.
Which means
if you don't like the carrier on your phone that the manufacturer dictates you shall have and you change it without authorization, you don't have the right to something you bought.
Could this symbiotic and actual relationship between Silicon Valley and the government, reflecting the deep state, explain the indulgence Washington has shown Silicon Valley on matters of intellectual property?
Absolutely. People no longer necessarily own their property that they buy if they're buying it from Silicon Valley. They simply have a kind of lease on it.
If, as you write, the ideology of the deep state is not Democrat or Republican, not left or right, what is it?
It's an ideology. I just don't think we've named it. It's a kind of corporatism. Now, the actors in this drama tend to steer clear of social issues. They pretend to be merely neutral servants of the state, giving the best advice possible on national security or financial matters. But they hold a very deep ideology of the Washington consensus at home, which is deregulation, outsourcing, deindustrialization, and financialization. And they believe in American exceptionalism abroad, which is boots on the ground everywhere. It's our right to meddle everywhere in the world. And the result of that is perpetual war.
You say it is shadowy and more ill-defined. More ill-defined than what?
It's more ill-defined than simply saying Wall Street or saying the military-industrial complex or saying Silicon Valley or the corporations. It's a symbiosis of all of the above.
Here's your summing up. Quote, as long as appropriations bills get passed on time, promotion lists get confirmed, black or secret budgets get rubber-stamped, special tax subsidies for certain corporations are approved without controversy. As long as too many awkward questions are not asked, the gears of the hybrid state will mesh noiselessly. Is that the ideology?
That is a government within a government that operates off the visible government and operates off the taxpayers, but it doesn't seem to be constrained in a constitutional sense, by the government.
Is there a solution to the way the system works now?
I think we're starting to see some discord in the ideology of the factions that make up the deep state. We're seeing Silicon Valley jump ship. They are starting to protest against the NSA. We're seeing the Tea Party bailing out against the deep state. They may be wrong on many economic issues, but I don't think they're necessarily wrong on this one.
So the public could be going wise?
I think they are. There's a much more vivid debate going on in the country about surveillance ever since the revelations by Edward Snowden.
Mike Lofgren, thank you very much for being with me.
It's good to be here, Bill.
Thanks to the journalist Li Feng, we have another revelation into how the deep state enterprise works. Writing for the Republic Report, a nonpartisan, nonprofit that investigates money in politics, he takes up that controversial trade deal called the Trans-Pacific Partnership that President Obama is trying to push through Congress with minimum debate and no amendments. Controversial because some of its provisions reportedly enable corporate power to trump representative government, even go around domestic courts and local laws. One is said to prevent governments from enacting safeguards against another bank crisis. Another, to empower corporations to sue governments for compensation if, say, environmental protections or regulations on tobacco and drugs interfered with future profits. Because of the secrecy, we don't know everything that's in the draft agreement. Senator Elizabeth Warren calls it a chance for these banks to get something done quietly out of sight that they could not accomplish in a public place with the cameras rolling and the lights on. Which brings us to two officials chosen by President Obama to lead those trade negotiations. Li Feng reports that they received multi-million dollar bonuses as they left giant financial firms to join the government. Bank of America gave this man, Stephen Selig, more than $9 million in bonus pay as he was nominated to become the Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade. And this man, Michael Froman, got over $4 million when he left Citigroup to become the current U.S. Trade Representative. Now, both are no doubt honorable men. They are all honorable men. But when push comes to shove and the financial interests of huge corporations are on the table, we can only hope they will act as independent men, not faithful servants of the deep state. But given the secrecy, we may never know. According to Li Feng, many large corporations with a strong incentive to influence public policy give executives bonuses and other incentive pay if they take jobs within the government. Among them, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan Chase, the Blackstone Group, Fannie Mae, Northern Trust. Citigroup even provides an executive contract that awards additional retirement pay upon leaving to take a full-time, high-level position with the U.S. government or regulatory body. I'm not making this up. You get a bigger incentive if you leave Wall Street to go regulate Wall Street. So it is the fox is groomed for the chicken coop, and the deep state grows fat.
Now, that's just some of the conversation. That is Mike Lofgren, and we will be having him on the program hopefully next week. Because when I talk about how corrupt the government agencies are today, I differentiate between what a government agency is supposed to do to protect and serve and create quality of life and create and protect the commons that we're all supposed to have access to, our parks, our rivers, and then look at the reality of the difference between what a very wealthy person, and by the way, he says it here, the number of contractors working within the military-industrial spy complex in Washington, I thought it was 200,000. It's 400,000. That's 400,000. Now, just imagine they're getting 75 cents out of every one of our tax dollars. We didn't know this. That's the deep state. That's why they need war. They need terrorism. That's why their funding regime changes around the world. That's why they're going into Iraq for no other reason than because they wanted Saddam Hussein's oil. And That's what they'd love to get out of Iran as well. And Libya, the same. Now, the fact they've made a mess out of it, they're not held accountable. There's no accountability for these people on any level. And they can spend any amount of money. Now, I don't know if you fully grasp what he said. To get 1 gallon of gasoline into a combat zone costs $400 per gallon. And that's because they get what is called cost-plus contracts, meaning no matter how much they spend, they get that back, plus they get profit on top of it. And there is no accounting. Trillions of dollars have gone missing in the Defense Department, the Pentagon's budgets, and no one seems concerned about it. So we will continue to be very diligent in giving you accurate quality material on how our tax dollars are wasted, how all we're doing is enabling those who are corrupt, greedy, and part of the continuing strife in our society. Remember, the deep state are the ones who own the private prison corporations. They get contracts with the state. They have to keep so many of those beds occupied at so much money per year per person. So there's an incentive to make minor crimes now felonies, to put people in jail for long periods of time. And who are the most susceptible right now? The refugees. So we will continue to expose the deep state. As we started to, we were the first to do it, and we will continue now that others are finally waking up to it.
Some folks know about